Hello and welcome to the Digital Health Podcast from Warwick Medical School. And today, for our episode, we are welcoming Professor Meg Davies.
Hello.
Thank you very much for joining us today, because you're quite an expert in this area, so we're very privileged to have you. And I just wondered if you could just share with us your journey, of course. So you're a professor in digital health and rights at our Warwick's own University Centre for Interdisciplinary Methodologies. And I understand that among all your other projects, you're the principal investigator for Digital Health and Rights Project, where we're reaching out to the digital inequalities internationally and looking at ways to alleviate them.
Yes.
Brilliant. So tell us a bit more.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here and to be part of this conversation. I started my career actually working in China as a China scholar, mm-hmm. and working on human rights with communities of people living with HIV and key populations affected by HIV.
Okay.
So where I did my doctoral work was in China, and then worked for Human Rights Watch, and then founded an NGO working with communities in China on health and human rights advocacy and governance issues, and then went to work for the Global Fund, and that eventually led me to work with the civil society groups that we co-founded this project together. It's using participatory action research in low and middle income countries.
Right. Could you expand on what participatory action research is for
sure.
our listeners? Thanks.
Yeah, so it is where the people who are being studied, instead of the research being done on them, it's done with them. So they participate in every stage of the research, in co-designing, making sure the tools and the instruments make sense in their context, helping to mobilize people, and then using the findings for advocacy and to try to address the issues we document.
Oh, that's a really interesting idea, actually. And that reaches into some of the things we'll talk about in this episode with regard to addressing the digital divide, actually. So that's very appropriate. And what are you doing right now with that research project? Are you sort of out interviewing in the field, or how does it work at the moment?
So we have just finished our big study with over 300 young people in Colombia, Ghana, Kenya, and Vietnam.
Wow.
Published a big report, and now using it to try to address some of those issues, working with civil society groups, academics, government, UN officials, trying to shift the needle.
Brilliant. So that sounds like a lot of exciting trips and a lot of diverse opinions you've picked up along the way.
Definitely, yes. Many diverse voices along the way.
Okay, well, hopefully that will bleed into some of the things we're talking about. Okay, so as our listeners will know by now, we're trying to address the Medical School Council's digital health competencies. And this week, we're looking at the Medical School Competency 10, which is exploring health inequalities. What I'd like to start with is discussing the importance of the diverse and representative data sets. So what's your experience in that area? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, well, I'm so glad that you're talking about this. I think it's really important to think about it as we move into this digital age, but also to look back at some fundamental principles that are really important
Please.
To remember. Number one of which is the human right to health. So under international human rights law, which the UK has signed on to and most countries have signed on to, that upholds the right to the highest attainable standard of physical and mental health. That means that we all have the right, we can't ensure that everyone has the right to be healthy, but we should all have the right to the same high quality of health information and services and goods and care. So whatever is accessible to people in London should be accessible all over the country, right? At the same standard.
Yeah.
And non-discrimination is a fundamental human rights principle. That means that we should not be disfavoring people based on, you know, race, gender, disabilities, or any other protected characteristic. And so how do we make those decisions? How do we determine what is the highest attainable standard and where it should go and who should have access to what? For that, we need data.
Yeah.
We need data that really helps us to set priorities, to allocate resources, funds, clinics, doctors, medicines, all of it. Without that data, we're operating in the dark. And that's the big challenge, because data is not always complete.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's, you know, that's really good aspiration to, you know, to reach towards. So when we're talking about the incomplete nature of a lot of the data in which we're operating, some of our listeners will be familiar with previous studies where we have found biases within our data sets. So if I was thinking about some of these, there have been AI algorithms looking at detection of skin cancers. There was an interesting Nature Journal article, which will be linked in the references, where what was found was, although the AI algorithm had been trained on over 129,000 case records, which was digital images, there was a large data skew within that, leaning towards research participants with lighter skin tones. And this led to a greater error rating in the dark skin toned individuals because they had lower data representation in the data research. And that led to a lower performance accuracy in the algorithm. And that's something that we really need to address going forward. And that's just one of many examples. There's another reference article in our references looking at the differences in gender representation with regard to presentations in acute chest pain. So what's found is that men and women present quite differently, actually, and the algorithm bias predominantly gave greater weighting to the male presentations of chest pain with regard to the more serious diagnoses of acute coronary syndromes and pulmonary embolus, and they were actually quite divergent to female presentations, which might often include more nausea, which is not necessarily typically associated in the male presentations. So that's definitely something that we can think about going forward. Mm-hmm. Are you aware of any particular examples where lack of representation in data has, led to poor health outcomes?
Yeah, we have numerous examples, and there are a lot of gaps in data, especially for women. Mm-hmm. So we know we often lack, in many countries, sex disaggregated data. So it makes it very hard for us to get a sense of how different health issues are manifesting in different genders. We are often missing data for the groups that are the most marginalized because they're least likely to be counted, or may be avoiding being counted because they're afraid of being criminalized, of facing other kinds of sanctions, especially for people who are migrants, racialized groups who might have less trust in the health system for lots of very sensible reasons. Mm. And this can lead to all kinds of biases in design, in services and tools. And then for the HIV response, for example, we have a big problem, which is lack of data around the key populations who are most affected by HIV. So sex workers, gay men and other men who have sex with men, trans people, people who use drugs. Countries often routinely underestimate the number of people in those populations, and it's hard to get their data, or countries don't really make much of an effort to get that data.
Okay.
And as a result, they're undercounted, and there's less services to meet their needs, and that then reinforces the lack of data. So you wind up in a kind of a vicious cycle.
Oh, I see, because you're not detecting the prevalence of the problem, and that leads to a resource allocation issue, which then potentiates the problem going forward.
Okay. That's right. Absence of evidence becomes evidence of absence.
I like that.
Yeah.
Okay, so we've talked a little bit there about some of the problems with the, with acquiring that data and how it's not necessarily representative in marginalized groups. But are you, in your work, have you found any meaningful ways in which researchers and potentially clinicians can ensure the inclusivity of their data and data collection so it's more representative and we don't lead to such biases going forwards with our AI algorithms and data sets?
Yeah, there are some good models. One is the SAGER guidelines. So these are new guidelines that have been developed to address gender inequality in research. So you really have to think from the outset when you're designing research, when you're working on a research protocol, how are you going to ensure that you have gender addressed appropriately in the data gathering process? It's important, of course, also to have diversity in the teams that are gathering the data, because another issue, we talk a lot about the data, which is important. We're not maybe talking enough about the assumptions behind algorithms, behind data gathering, where we're not even seeing something that we should be looking for because we're just not familiar with the problem. And so there, having really diverse people in the room can actually help, because someone who has a different background might point out, well, actually, you haven't thought about trans people in this situation. You haven't thought about migrants and why they might not be getting captured by this approach. So diversity in research teams is also very, very important. And then the approach we're using, community engaged and participatory citizen science approaches, those also can be very powerful as a way to reshape the inequalities in data gathering so that the community actually has a voice in defining the problem, gathering the data, and then using it.
Brilliant. I think those ideas are really strong. You know, diversity in the research teams, you know, that's a key kind of principle. And citizen science, just to elaborate on that, so that's leaning into the participatory research methodologies. And how might one incorporate that idea and utilize that strength? So how do you practically engage those opinions in your research work?
So for our project, we have a community advisory team that advises the project at every stage, and that includes people from the study population, so from our previous studies. It includes civil society representatives working on the issues and community representatives, which are different from civil society. So civil society could be people who are from an elite background running a well-funded operation, but they might have a very different perspective than a community representative who might see things quite differently. So we try to have all those different voices in the room when we think about the research, the data, recruitment, all of those things, and then analyzing the data as well so that we get their voices in that process.
So at every stage, really, we're ensuring that we're taking steps to mitigate the weight of bias.
Mm-hmm. And it's definitely a lot more work, but the results, I think, are much richer and more meaningful. And it also means that if I, as a researcher, lose interest in digital health and go off to work on astrophysics or something else, that the data and the knowledge stays in the community. And so they continue to have authority, expertise, and ability to work on the issues longer term.
Ah, okay. So it has also added strength in terms of dissemination of findings and traction of those findings, not necessarily specifically within the scientific community, but within the populations being studied. And that's really, that's really important as well. So if we could talk a little bit about the digital divide and access to care at the moment. So what does that mean to you in a healthcare context, the digital divide?
Yeah, the digital divide refers to gaps in access to internet and digital technologies. And it refers to a variety of different kinds of gaps. So often we think of the digital divide as meaning who has a smartphone or a laptop or a tablet, who has internet access. But in the context of the work that I do in the Digital Health and Rights Project, we think about divides as being multiple and intersecting. So they can include internet access, and we know that 1/3 of the world lacks internet access, and that people with lower incomes often struggle to afford digital devices. They might not have access to broadband in some countries, and so they might have to pay for airtime whenever they want to get online to check a symptom or consult with a healthcare worker. Rural areas in particular lack internet access even more. But also the kinds of education people have. So when they get online, are they able to navigate not just in terms of pointing and clicking, but in terms of judging the reliability of different kinds of information?
Okay, so that's a sort of a, that's a skills divide in terms of a digital health literacy.
That's right.
In terms of your strength of differentiating, you know, the wheat from the chaff.
Yes, that's right. And then also, the fact is that there are, you know, hundreds and hundreds of languages in the world, but actually the internet is not available in all of them. And so health information might be available only in official languages, but you might have many people in a given country who speak many other languages and are not comfortable in the official language. So that means they both have to learn how to navigate in the official language and judge, you know, the value of information in that other language.
And that can be confusing for, you know, even, you know, first language English speakers with, you know, with the kind of volume of data and the speed that it's produced at the moment.
That's right. And then gender really affects this cross-cutting across all these other divides, because we know that women tend to have additional economic inequalities, so they might have less ability to pay for a smartphone, to pay for airtime. They might be dependent on male partners for both of those things. They may face social inequalities, including lack of access to education, or gender norms that say in some countries, well, women shouldn't be on the internet, the internet is for men. You know, only bad girls have smartphones.
Okay.
There's a lot of that kind of thing that we encounter in our research. And so that means that if they are using a smartphone to get online, they might be sharing it with a family member or a partner or a parent. And that also limits what they can search for. You might be hesitant to search for contraceptive advice if you're married and sharing your phone with your partner, or if you have a parent who's supervising what you look for.
And I imagine that has added weight in some of the work you're looking at, for example, in your HIV studies. There would be that'd be particularly important kind of considerations.
Yes, in fact, one of the young women that we spoke with told us that when she was 14, she was sharing her smartphone with her sister, and she got a very well-intentioned message from her healthcare provider reminding her to take her antiretroviral treatment. And her sister saw that and told the father. And the father didn't know that his daughter was living with HIV and kicked her out of the house at 14 years old. So very important, I think, for medical professionals to bear in mind that text messages are not always confidential, and important to check about that before messaging someone, just on a very pragmatic level.
I think that's a really important issue you bring up there. And actually, that speaks to me clinically at the moment, because we often send out our text messages in primary care at the moment to the registered numbers of a healthcare account, electronic healthcare record, and actually the access of that phone number is, you know, it's sometimes not clearly delineated, and it may well be, you know, an influential male partner or you know, or a parental account as well. So try as we might, we've got to always be cognizant of that potential for you know, data transparency and data security in that area.
Exactly.
Brilliant. Okay, so if we're thinking about the groups that are most at risk to a risk to be being left behind within the digital digital divide. We've talked about socioeconomically challenged groups, and we've talked about the, you know, the gender disparity within that. And we've talked about the significance of language within our digital health media. Are there any other significant groups that you feel might be becoming at risk of marginalization with the increasing digitization of healthcare?
Yes, I think probably the most obvious group is older people. And any of us who's supporting a parent or an older relative with access to their health information knows that privacy kind of goes out the window if you cannot manage your own online access. And so for a lot of older people, that is a big challenge, that they no longer can look up to see their test results, to book an appointment, to make sure that, you know, anything really relating to health is all now online, it's all through a phone. And phones are not always friendly for older people because of the size of the keys and the screens and so forth. So that is a big challenge, I think, as well.
Yeah, and that's a problem I increasingly see in my clinical context. And whilst by no means is it true that we've got to be careful to not overgeneralize here, and I've many octogenarians who are fully conversant with their NHS app, and they're telling me they've already checked their results, and they've Googled what they might mean and want to discuss that further with me. It is also true that we, in our attempts to increase access and push information out via the NHS app onto people's smartphones, we actually do, by prioritizing those new ways of working, we do risk, and I increasingly see, actually marginalize some of the non-digital natives, if you wanted to use that terminology, who end up getting a text message with a link to a clinic appointment or a website which they're not really very good at navigating, for both physical reasons that you're talking about, sometimes in terms of visual impairments or coordination impairments, with utilization of touch sensitive screens. And we have to make sure that these newer techniques of accessing healthcare are also available in other formats where we don't risk exacerbating the digital divide.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so do you know of any examples where or ways in which healthcare systems, apart from leaving the old access routes available, like the old telephones and stuff, can help to bridge this digital data divide?
Mm-hmm. It is really challenging because there seems to be no going back. We do seem to be increasingly reliant on these digital tools and platforms. There are some good models. So actually right here in Coventry, there's a quite innovative collaboration between Coventry City Council and some community-based organizations where the government is redistributing used phones to people who are here, who are refugees or migrants or people on the move, and then working in collaboration with community-based organizations that have the trust of those communities to have digital advisors or digital champions who help people to get online and help them to navigate, set up profiles, understand how it all works. And that kind of collaboration, I think, is really the way of the future. I think it's a really promising approach.
Well, that's really good. So that's a digital health advocacy situated within the marginalized communities.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds like a really good project. And if it's okay with you, we'd share the link to that in our references.
Yeah, that's great. I'm happy to promote them. I think it's a really nice approach. I also think, we have to think creatively about ways to give people access who might not have access. So even having a couple of computers, in the medical facility to give people a way to check online for information or to communicate independently without having to go through a shared phone, that would also be helpful. In some countries, we see Wi-Fi points where people can just go into the room and use a computer in a community that may not have a lot of computers. So things like that, I think, are really valuable to expand access to communities that might not have it regularly.
I think that's a really good idea, and something I came across in my research before this episode was the significance in that some health communities were some professional health communities were finding in training their healthcare professionals to assess the digital literacy of their patients, and by that I mean, building on what we said earlier, that you couldn't always assume that your octogenarian patient or second language learner wouldn't be very proficient in the utilization of these new tools, but how to sensitively probe the self-efficacy of the patients in those areas, and I think training towards quick and simple ways in which we could do that would be important going forward. Good. Okay. So I guess the final topic really we wanted to look at here was about data privacy and the vulnerable and specifically within vulnerable populations, but across all of the demographics. Can you think From your very varied experiences across what sounds like a lot of very vulnerable populations, in addition to things like your anecdote there about that 14-year-old girl, unfortunately, but can you think of any other examples of why these vulnerable populations are at kind of greater risks with regard to their own data privacy?
Yeah, definitely. So in this study that we just did in Colombia, Ghana, Kenya, and Vietnam, one of the first questions we asked young people in our study who were between 18 to 30 was, what are the main barriers you face to accessing health information and services on your phone? And we expected the main barrier to be what we've just been talking about in terms of lack of access to phones and data. Actually, it was stigma. So the number one concern across all four countries was young people saying, I'm afraid that people will find out that I'm living with HIV, that I'm gay, that I'm a sex worker, that I'm trans, that I'm a sexually active young person, and that this then can be used to harm me. It can be used to cause my expulsion from the home, loss of job. We have stories about young people being monitored by teachers at schools in some cases. And so there was a lot of anxiety about, how well is my data protected? How secure am I online? Am I exposed to the risk of blackmail or extortion, which we also know is widespread? In addition, about 3/4 of the young people in our study said that either they or their friends had experienced abuse online, including stalking, verbal abuse. In some cases, the abuse would move from online to offline with people experienced being harmed in person.
Wow.
Linked to the online abuse. And in particular in Ghana, where there's a quite draconian anti-homosexuality bill on the books, we had reports of young people who'd been lured from potential dates online into ambushes in person, violent ambushes. And none of the people that we spoke to really felt that they had an access to anyone to report the crimes to or the abuse to. You report it to the platform, 50% of the time, nothing happens. You go to the police, they might say, well, you shouldn't be online doing this stuff, or the laws don't say anything about this issue. And so in effect, they're being left to protect themselves. And that means, without really understanding what is happening with their data online, they're left a little bit to operate in the dark. And it was a big challenge for them.
That does sound like a very worrying situation, and I can really foresee how concerns about stigma and discrimination and abuse with regard to data leaks and data security would really predispose people to remove themselves from engagement with the new digital health technologies, and I can see quite rightly so at the moment if they're at risk of that kind of discrimination. So that really will lead into exacerbating the digital divide within those minoritized populations.
That's right. And so I think, when we think about what the implications are for health providers, I think something that's important is not only to be doing all the things we need to do to comply with data privacy regulations and guidelines, but also to communicate to the public what we're doing to protect their data, how it's being secured, and where they can go if they experience a breach, so that there actually is some sense of accountability. As well as, I think we need to think more about support for people who experience this kind of abuse. Think about the mental health impacts and responding to what I think is really an epidemic of online harms that really needs to be addressed as a health issue.
If, for example, any of our listeners were, in that situation about, one of their patients had become aware of a data breach online with regard to some of their, sexual health information, how would they advocate for that in the UK? How would they advocate for that patient, supporting that patient, do you think?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question, because I don't know the laws in the UK. I know that there are attempts to pass new laws underway, but I think it might be worthwhile trying to really map out the available services and avenues for recourse, because I think it is a growing issue, and we've been focused a lot on the harms against children, which we should, because they're really a vulnerable group. But we're not talking enough, I think, about the epidemic of online abuse among young adults.
Brilliant. Okay, well, I think we're, we've talked about a lot of different issues there, and we're kind of coming to the end of our time. Mm-hmm. So I really want to kind of thank you for all of your, for sharing, your very varied story and your travels throughout the world. And I just wondered if you had any final thoughts and advice for our listeners about where they could find out more about digital health inequalities.
Yeah, thank you so much. And it's been really nice to have this conversation. Appreciate the space for this. We have a website for our project, digitalhealthandrights.com. And on that site, we also have a digital empowerment hub, which is about 200 or more tools, training resources, guidelines for people to use to learn about their human rights in digital health. So really encourage everyone to check that out, share it with others. It can be used in workshops, can be used one-on-one, and also to share with us if you find other tools and resources like that.
Oh, that sounds really good. Well, we'll definitely put those links in for all of our listeners.
Great.
And this wasn't your first podcast, was it?
No, that's right. So during the COVID pandemic, I actually ran a podcast. We did about 6 episodes called The Right On Podcast that was interviewing human rights advocates and experts about health and human rights in the COVID pandemic.
Brilliant. Okay, well, that sounds like another really interesting listen for our listeners. So I'll link that in our references section. And I look forward to speaking to you guys all again in our next week's episode. But it's for now, bye from me. And
thank you so much. Goodbye.